Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, 10th canto, chapter 51, The Deliverance of Muchukunda, text 44. Sri Shuka Vacha. Ityuktas tampanam yaha. Muchukundo mudanvita. Yatra Narayanam Devam Gargavakyam Anusmaran Ityuktastam Pranam Yaha Muchukundo Mudanvita Yatra Narayanam Devam Gargavakyam Anusmaran Ityuktastam Pranangyaha Muchukundo Mudanvita Yatva Narayanam Devam Gargavakyam Anusmaran Vaishnavis, Vaishnavis. Sri Shukavacha. Shukadev Goswami said, iti, thus, ukta, addressed, tam, to him, pranamya, after bowing down, aha, said, muchukunda, muchukunda, muda, with joy, anvita, filled, gyata, knowing him to be, Narayanam Devam, Narayana, the Supreme Lord, Gargavakyam, the words of the sage Garga, Anusmaran, remembering. Translation. Shukadev Goswami said, Muchukunda bowed down to the Lord when he heard this. Remembering the words of the sage Garga, he joyfully recognized Krishna to to be the Supreme Lord, Narayan. The king then addressed him as follows. Purport. Although the Lord here appears as four-handed Narayana, we may say that Muchukunda was addressing Sri Krishna. All this is taking place within the context of Krishna Leela, the pastimes of Lord Krishna. It is well known to Vaishnavas that the four-handed forms of Vishnu or Narayan are expansions of Sri Krishna. Thus, within the pastimes of Lord Krishna, there may also appear Vishnu Leela, the activities of Vishnu. Such are the qualities and activities of the Supreme Godhead. Deeds that, for us, would be extraordinary and even impossible are commonplace, effortless pastimes for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Srila Sridhar Swami informs us that Muchukunda was aware of the prediction of the ancient sage Garga that in the 28th millennium the Supreme Lord would descend. According to Acharya Vishwanath, Garga Muni further informed Muchukunda that he would personally see the Lord. Now it was all happening. Om Gana Chimadandasya. Gananjana Shalakaya. Chakshun Militang Yena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasudhi Gaur Bhaktavrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. In this pastime, the deliverance of Muchukunda, incidental to it is the death of Kalyavana. It is not that Lord Krishna entered this cave and had as the foremost purpose in his mind the death of Kalyavana. No, Krishna's number one motivation was to reciprocate with his devotee, Muchukunda. As we all know, the Lord is Bhaktavatsala. He's the most affectionate in loving reciprocation. Therefore, the dispatching of Kalyavana was routine. Something that happened as a corollary. Let us look at an overview of the whole situation. You have both devotees and demons relying on the words of authority. Narada Muni. You have also the wrath and the blessings of the sadhu, Gargarishi. So we go back to the beginning to understand how is it that Kalyavana originated. There was some disrespect somehow or other shown by the Yadu dynasty to Gargarishi. And Gargarishi felt slighted enough that he decided to conceive a son who would be very inimical and dangerous to the Yadu dynasty. So Gargarishi found a Yavana woman and conceived a son in her. And indeed, according to the desires of Gargarishi, that son, Kalyavana, was capable of being a threat to the Yadu dynasty. Of course, the Yadu dynasty is it's undefeatable. But at least Kalyavana would give them reason to take notice of his prowess. So, in his maturity, the life of a demon, Kalyavana wanted to find out, I'm so great, I'm so powerful, who is the most, who's the strongest foe that I can tangle with? So whom did he approach to get this knowledge from? He wanted a suitable opponent. He approached the authority, Narada Muni. So just see. He relied upon the vision of Narada Muni. And Narada Muni, understanding how Krishna's pastimes are to unfold, Narada Muni pointed him in the direction of the Yadus. Go for them. They are the ones. So therefore, as you know, Kalyavana began to attack Mathura just at the same time Jarasandha was attacking for the 18th time. The Shastra says that Kalyavana was attacking with 6 million soldiers. You know how Krishna decided to cope with the crisis, which was not really a crisis for him at all. We were speaking yesterday at, was it Somaya College. And we were talking about crises and how Bhagavad Gita is the master text for how to deal with crises and utilize them for the highest benefit. I quoted one Stanford economist who, at the start of the global financial crisis in 2008, made a statement that's oft repeated: a crisis is a terrible thing to waste. They're saying like that at the beginning of the global crisis. They didn't expect it would drag on and on. Now, by this time, the crisis has lost some of its charisma and charm. But anyway, I explained to the students, in Bhagavad Gita, you see that Krishna and Arjuna are not wasting this crisis. They are maximizing this challenge in terms of its potential. That is the way of bhakti. Whatever happens leads to an increase in devotion to Krishna, an increase in service. Kalyavana, after Krishna walked out of Mathura, as you know, began chasing after him. Stop, stop, stop. He ran as fast as he could, but he could not catch up with Krishna, who was leisurely walking away. Contrast that to what you've been singing this morning in the Dhammadharastika. Paramishtam atyantato drutyagopya. The little Damodar Krishna is running from Mother Yashoda, and she can catch him. Not only can she catch him, but in the Dhammadharastika prayer, Sri Satyavrata Muni explains that she apprehended him from behind, like you catch a thief. He's running, you catch up to him, and you grab him from behind. This chasing of Krishna is a great mystery. So much so that you read in the first canto of Bhagavatam, Queen Kunti Devi, commenting on this. How could this happen? Fear itself is afraid of Krishna, yet Krishna is afraid of Mother Yashoda's stick. What is going on here? And you know how Damodar Krishna once apprehended by Mother Yashoda, and Mother Yashoda created such a beautiful sight in chasing after Krishna. Her beautiful transcendental form, the flower petals falling from the flower decorations in her hair. When she finally captures Krishna, Krishna puts on the most famous demonstration of fear in existence. He makes his whole body shake as he's sobbing. He's breathing heavily. Tears are flowing from his eyes and mixing with the black mascara around his eyes. He's putting on a whole production. The whole purpose of the production is so that Mother Yashoda will not punish him. So the first wonder is that she caught him. The second wonder is that she has Krishna's hand in one of her hands, and in the other hand she has a stick. And Krishna is determined he's not going to be punished. And as you know, the situation is resolved by Mother Yashoda thinking about how to be a good parent. It's not good if my child is too afraid of me. This is not good child psychology. She didn't need to go to the university to understand psychology. Early childhood psychology, it's called in the Western world. She knew. In Krishna Leela, everyone knows exactly what to do for increasing Krishna's pleasure. They don't have to think about it, because that is the nature of the perfection of spontaneous love. She caught Krishna, but Kalyavana couldn't come close. And he couldn't figure out why. He was infuriated. In this way, like a materialistic scientific researcher, he could not accept the transcendental reality. He considered simply that Krishna is a coward. For some reason, I, with all my prowess, can't catch him. But that in no way means Krishna is special. Special meaning beyond the material. No, he's a material phenomenon. And if I can't catch him running, I'll catch him another way. But he will be within my grasp. He will fall within the range of my sense perception. He will fall within the range of my ability to make material solutions. He had that complete arrogance and confidence. There is nothing outside of the material realm. And soon we will see the end of this Krishna, who obviously is afraid of me. Why else would he run? It all adds up. Use your material intelligence and make the same calculation. So that's why when Kalyavana got to the cave that Krishna had gone into, and he saw this sleeping form on the ground, Kalyavana made a brilliant deduction, right? All this running that coward Krishna has been doing has made him tired, of course. Therefore, he's laying down. It's all so obvious. Use your intelligence. What is the mystery? There is no divine causation. There is no transcendental complexity to consider. He was running, and he's tired now. Okay, while he was running, I couldn't catch him. But one who runs, sooner or later, must become exhausted. It all makes sense. I've done my scientific analysis, and there you see, in plain sight, what is the conclusion. I'll go up, and I'll give this sleeping Krishna a kick. I'm fair. I'm an honorable Kshatriya. I would never attack a sleeping person. I already know he's afraid of me. I want to fight. I'll kick him, and then we'll fight. And you know what happened when he kicked that sleeping person? He awakened Muchukunda. And Muchukunda, coming out of his long sleep, gradually focused his vision on this Kalyavana and activated the benediction that the demigods like Kartikeya had given him. If anyone disturbs your sleep, you're asking for the benediction that you can burn them to ashes with your gaze. All right, so be it. try to understand how tired Muchukunda must have been to ask for such a benediction. Sometimes devotees in their intense labors to serve Krishna feel so tired they feel like they could sleep for a week. But they don't ask for such a benediction. Maybe you would pray, please, may the alarm clock malfunction tomorrow. So, upon the death of Kalyavana, Muchukunda became aware of an unlimitedly radiant personality in the cave. And he began to ask questions. So we're dealing now with an issue of identity. In this dialogue between Muchukunda and Krishna, you're going to see some identity issues resolved. We've dealt with the anger of Gargarishi. Somehow or other the Yadus slighted him, and therefore Kalyavana was produced. Now we're dealing with the benedictions of Gargarishi. And we're hearing about that in this verse via Srila Sridhar Swami and Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. Gargarishi had informed earlier, he had informed Muchukunda that you will see the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Muchukunda began to identify himself because he understood it's respectful when you're dealing with someone obviously far superior to you, that as you're asking, who are you, you describe who you are. Muchukunda was analyzing the situation not simply based on his sense perception. He was thinking about the Shastra. I'm seeing something extraordinary. What could it be that I'm seeing? Am I seeing a demigod? Am I seeing the Supreme Personality of Godhead? So in asking those kind of questions, he's thinking of the different qualifications each of those personalities could have. If you're a demigod, you're like this. If you're the Supreme Personality of Godhead, you're like that. Then he decided he would ask, who are you? Although he was already quite convinced this is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Krishna explained, actually, you're asking an inconceivably difficult question. And it'll be very difficult for me to answer. Who am I? I have so many names. I have so many forms. So many appearances. It will be extremely difficult for you or anyone to understand who I am. Arjuna encountered a bit of this difficulty in Bhagavad Gita. Krishna, how could you speak to Vivaswan millions upon millions of years ago, when you're here with me, we're friends? What's going on here? And that, of course, is when Krishna explained. Many, many births, many, many appearances, both you and I have had. I can remember all of them. So in speaking to Muchukunda, Krishna reiterated this point. How are you going to focus on who I am? I'm not a personality who's limited. I have unlimited names, forms, unlimited activities. Even if you could count all the particles of dust in the cosmos, you still won't be able to understand all my unlimited names, forms, qualities, and pastimes. But just to make it easy on you, I'll tell you about who I am in this appearance. This establishing of identity is very important. And you would be shocked to know that it is the nature of identity that is the greatest crisis in the world today. The confusion that exists amongst learned persons as to what is the self has reached an all-time level. You have one camp, the hardcore materialists. Now, I'm going to explain this in a way that anyone can understand, because it's actually not very complex. But it's in the interest of those who want to obliterate any spiritual understanding of identity to make the issue sound so complex. So in one camp, you have the hardcore reductionist materialists. They are hell-bent, literally hell-bent on reducing any kind of phenomena to just interactions of matter according to the known laws of physics. Whatever you see, light, a rainbow, this microphone, the floor you're sitting on, you yourself, everything can be reduced to just, roughly speaking, bits of matter. So what does that mean about your self-identity? It means, actually, there's no such thing as a self. How can you reduce a self to just tiny aspects of matter? How can you do that? There's no such thing. And because we know for a fact that everything is just gross matter, everything is physical. This is also called physicalism. Since we know that's a fact, therefore, obviously, there's no self. Simply, the brain conjures up an illusion that there is a self-identity. So that's one school. Then there's another school that's more munificent and more, broad-minded, as they describe themselves. So, no, this hardcore materialism, which says that there's no self, and that the self is just an illusion conjured up by the brain, that is too extreme. Look at the situation, practically. Number one, you know that conscious awareness exists because you have it. And everyone will tell you they have it. So we've got to accept that as a fact. That conscious awareness exists. It's not just an illusion produced by the brain. Number two, all states of consciousness are produced by the brain. Actually, that is not a scientific fact. All they can say is that states of consciousness are associated with particular neurological activity. That's all. Therefore, if they want to be honest and precise, they should use the term neural correlates of consciousness. The brain activity is associated in some way with your various states of awareness, but it doesn't mean one causes the other. But you've got to make that very murky. That way it's better to get research funds. Get grants. So, yeah, I've heard foremost scientific researchers in consciousness explain like this. No, we're not like the materialistic reductionists. We admit that consciousness, the self, exists, but we're going to tell you what it is. It's all about the brain. This is called biological naturalism. This is the munificent, more elevated version as compared to the gross materialist. Biological naturalism means that your brain's activity produces consciousness, produces the awareness of a self. It does exist, but it's produced by the brain. So those in this munificent camp say, look, you know that gross materialism is wrong. You're not going to agree with scientists like Stephen Hawking, who says, just face it, you're simply chemical scum. You are, but not exactly. So you reject gross materialism. You can't reduce consciousness to anything. And materialists, gross materialists, say that everything material must be reduced. But you can't do that to consciousness. So what's your other option? We have such wonderful spiritual traditions and philosophies that say consciousness indicates a non-material self coexisting with a material reality. Now, that's not even near being false. It's incoherent. Now you might wonder why that quick dismissal. It's not even false. It doesn't get to the level yet of being false, this idea that there's a spirit soul that's emanating consciousness. It's not near being false, and it is ludicrous. Now, you might think, well, why respond in that way? Anthropologists have shown that one of the universal understandings of all cultures in human history, from primitive to so-called advanced, they all accept that there is a non-material self. But these anthropologists say there's just one tiny segment of a particular species that doesn't accept this. That tiny section of the human species that is adamant there is no spiritual self. So why, whether you're a hardcore materialist or the slightly upgraded, more righteous version, the biological naturalist, yes, consciousness exists, but it's produced by the brain. Why do they take these hardcore positions? Because as soon as you admit that there's something non-material about you, what does that mean? There's a non-material energy, there's a non-material reality. What scientist knows anything about that? Therefore, it doesn't exist. You cannot entertain the possibility. It's ludicrous. So keep the situation of understanding the self totally bound up within material understanding. We have no other choice. This is the point you have to understand. Once you finger this trigger point, you've got the whole thing figured out. There is no choice. As soon as, many times our devotees don't understand the implications of dehi no smriti dehi komaram jovanam, because stated so simply, sometimes we even get tired of repeating it, right? When can I give a talk and not have to say dehi no smriti? I remember Prabhupada here in Juhu, over in Juhu, he had just come up with his umpteenth example of, of how you're not the body and how Dehinos Vinyatahe applies. And then suddenly he stopped and said, why am I always able to come up with these examples? Because I'm always thinking about it. Prabhupada is always thinking about Dehinos Vinyatahe. Bhagavad Gita chapter 2, every new bhakta knows it. But you see, as soon as you concede that there is a self that doesn't change, although the body and mind change, as soon as you concede that, admit that, then everything opens up to the non-materiality. And then you have to decide, are you going to be a Mayavadi or a Krishna Bhakta? So therefore, what this demoniac propaganda is doing is shutting things down at the very beginning. There's no self, there's no consciousness. Take your choice. You can be softer and say, there is conscious awareness, but there is a conscious self, but it's produced by biological, neurochemical activity in the brain. And therefore, it is ludicrous to think that there's a non-material self, because that opens the door to understanding a non-materiality that functions according to laws we have no idea about. And we don't want to go there. We don't want to think about that. Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, prastasmat tu bhavanyo, vyaktyo vyakta, sanatana. There's another nature. No way. There is no other nature. So that is the mentality behind all the confusion. We've got to shut down any possibility that people could think there is a non-material self, because that means there's a non-materiality, and things just will get totally wild and out of hand then, once we let that cat out of the bag. So therefore, we're doing our duty, and we're locking this idea of anything non-material, we're locking it up in a box and throwing it deep into the ocean. So this is another way of explaining why this identity discussion between Muchagunda and Krishna is so important. Each one is establishing his identity. And you know about Muchagunda's presentation of his autobiography. It's almost as exciting as Journey Home. I was king of the world. I had such power. I had such enjoyment. The ordinary person, Muchakunda admitted, has such a hard time being attached to his body and a few possessions. But as king of the world, I thought everything in the world was mine. And then he very beautifully begins to describe the effect of time. No matter how much power and wealth you have in this world, time takes it all away. And in Prabhupada's beautifully put presentation of Muchakunda's statement, Muchakunda says, I forgot about time, but what? Time did not forget about me. Very beautiful, so eloquent. Like a black snake pouncing upon a mouse at the right time, time will strike. So in that way, Muchakunda attributed the movements of time to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But then he said, there's another aspect of time that I also submitted to. He considered his sense gratification to be an aspect of time. In other words, it is time that's not simply deteriorating things. Time is also delivering to you your material happiness and distress. So that's why, in describing his sense gratification, Muchakunda was considering it under the banner of time. He said, that I had during the day such unparalleled power that all the neighboring kings who were inferior to me, they would come during the day and bow down at my feet, crashing their helmets on the floor at my feet. This is time. But time also manifested another way. At night, I would have to go to my ladies' quarters and fall at their feet begging for sense gratification. That is also the effect of time. Muchakunda described himself. Actually, Muchakunda, from his previous birth, was longing for the association of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. What you're seeing in the history of Muchakunda is a three-birth affair. In the previous life, he was longing for Krishna's association. In this life, he got Krishna's association. Krishna went to the cave, as we said, not mainly to kill Kaliyavana, but to bless Muchakunda. And so now, we're at the point where Krishna is going to offer Muchakunda whatever you want, you can have. Just like Lord Nrisingadeva told Prahlad Maharaj, it's my pastime to fulfill all the desires of my devotees. So similarly, Krishna presented Muchakunda with that full range of possibilities. You can ask me whatever you want. At the same time, the acharyas hint, Jiva Goswami hints that Krishna was saying, you know it's best just to ask for surrender. It's a test. Just like Nrisingadeva tested Prahlad. The test is not meant to make the devotee fail. It's meant to glorify the devotee. Just like when Krishna tested Arjuna in the Ashwatthama incident. To kill him or not kill him. Krishna told Arjuna, remember, you promised your wife you're going to kill him. Go ahead. Arjuna understood the deeper purport to what Krishna is saying. So it's not that Krishna was trying to trick Arjuna. I'm going to put you in a tricky situation and I'm going to tell you something that actually has hidden meanings just to trip you up. No, Krishna wants to glorify his devotee. Throughout the Bhagavatam, you'll see the Supreme Personality of Godhead testing the devotee in order to advertise the glories of the devotee. The Supreme Personality of Godhead did that with Prithu in the fourth canto. Ask for me any benediction. And Prithu just asked for pure devotional service and the association of pure devotees. Lord Nrisingadeva did it with Prahlad. Prahlad, what was his very humble response when Nrisingadeva said, you can ask me any benediction you like. Prahlad said, my dear Lord Nrisinga, let's consider my family background here. Let's look at the sociology. After all, I'm the son of the greatest demon. So you shouldn't dangle the possibility of material desires in front of me, knowing my background. I am eternally your servant. You are eternally the master. We have no other relationship than this. This is transcendental reductionism. Prahlad Maharaj reduced everything to this basic principle of servitude. There's nothing else going on except I'm your servant, you're the master. There's nothing else going on now, and there'll never be anything else going on in the future. I'm your servant unconditionally, and you are my unconditional master. And then you look in the 10th canto. No, before 10th canto. End of the 9th canto. Shukadeva Goswami was testing Prichit Maharaj. The last verses of the ninth canto, in which you see a prelude to Krishna Leela coming in the tenth canto. That is Shukadeva Goswami's testing of Arjuna, of Prichit Maharaj. Are you really eager to hear what's coming next? Are you on the edge of your seat, so to speak? Are you sure you're ready? It's Shukadeva Goswami testing him. Because those last few verses of the ninth canto whet your appetite for the feast that's to come. And then, in Gopi Leela, when Krishna played his flute in the middle of the night, and his dearmost devotees ran off to be him with him in the middle of the forest in the middle of the night, what did Krishna say? Go back home to your husbands. Go back home to your family. It's not good for you to be here. This is also Krishna testing, the acharyas point out. It seems like he's presenting ordinary kula dharma. You shouldn't come out here to be with me. You have your families. You have your husband. What is the transcendental reality? They're all Krishna's energy. They all belong to Krishna. But just to test their attachment, he says, go home, go home, go home. And then his dearmost devotees, the gopis, are staring off into the forest as Krishna's speaking like that, as someone would do when another person says something unpalatable. You just kind of look away. So Krishna saw the gopis doing that as he was saying, go home, go back to your husbands. They're looking into the forest. And what does Krishna say? Oh, I see. Now I understand. The real reason why you're here is not because of me. You just want to see the beauty of the forest. All right. Have you seen enough of the beauty of the nighttime forest? Now go home. So the acharyas point out this is a test. Similarly, when Krishna sent Uddhava with a message to Vrindavan, and that message contained what could be considered as jnana. Everything is me. Why should you feel that I'm not there when everything around you, all of nature, all the material is also me? This is a test, the acharyas point out. Similarly, when the resident of Vrindavan met Krishna at Kurukshetra for the solar eclipse, and finally Krishna's dearmost devotees got to see him again, and Krishna in private instructed them, and again he said something that could be considered jnana yoga. I am the self of all. I am everywhere. So the acharyas point out this is Krishna testing. And of course the response of his dearmost devotees was that we just want your presence as we're executing our simple household duties. Come back to Vrindavan with us and be present with us no matter what we are doing. And the final test in Bhagavatam is in the 12th canto. Prichit Maharaj is about to leave this world, and Shukadeva Goswami seems to digress. He starts talking about knowledge of jnana, how you're not the body, how matter is distinct from spirit. This is just to galvanize Prichit Maharaj. You want to think about Krishna. And Prichit Maharaj, before he departs, tells Shukadeva Goswami, you can go now. Your job is done. my consciousness is fixed completely on Krishna. So these tests are not meant to antagonize devotees or trip them up, make them fail. These tests are meant to bring out the devotee's bhakti and enhance it. So similarly, it seems that the Supreme Personality of Godhead is testing Muchakunda. Ask me whatever you want. The Supreme Personality of Godhead knows in advance that his devotee will pass the test. It's not that it's outside of his knowledge. How will this devotee succeed in this situation? But Krishna wants to demonstrate to the world the glories of his devotees. Sometimes, even we ordinary devotees are tested. Srila Prabhupada points out that in one purport in the 8th canto that Krishna never tests a devotee more than the devotee has been prepared for. But sometimes we have a hard time accepting that. This is too much. I mean, oh, why, Krishna? Why are you doing this to me? Oh. So many of us have been through situations in which this is unbearable. Why me? What did I do? A good teacher, even in the material sense, never tests students beyond what the student has been prepared for. Why would you think Krishna would do that? Do we think Krishna is some kind of sadist or, you know, he wants to torture his devotees? I dangle the sweetest taste of bhakti, I dangle it before you, and then as soon as you try to get it, I put you in a situation that just finishes you off. Sometimes we think that bhakti is some kind of torturous course. I remember some university students were telling me how, not in India, but in the West, how their teacher told them, all right, it's time for the final exam. I want you all to master the material. So what I'm going to do is put all the exam questions on the bulletin board outside the classroom so that next week when you take your final exam, by that time you'll have ample opportunity to thoroughly master the subject matter. I'm not interested in making your life miserable. I want you to know the material. So, of course, the students were very happy. They don't do that here, do they? I put all the exam questions. Tomorrow I'm going to post them outside the classroom. And that way you can just thoroughly know the material. It's a good way to teach, to give all the information and give the student ample time to process. But this is the material world. What happened? The teacher did that. But then some selfish student went to the bulletin board the next day and said, oh, here are all the questions. I don't even feel like copying them down. I'll take the... I'll just take the paper down and, you know, that's it. You know, yeah. It's life in the material world, you know. Hey. So the students went to the bulletin board. There were no questions there. They called up the teacher. And what was the teacher's response? What do you want out of me? I've done my job. I put the questions there. You guys took them down. It's not my problem. He actually said that. Why would we ever think Krishna would treat us in such a way? So it is an essential point to understand that Krishna never tests you more than what you've been prepared for. So therefore, when a testing situation comes for a devotee, he never blames Krishna. He begs Krishna, I know that you have prepared me for this. I just right now don't feel that way, but please enlighten me. How you are giving me the best care in the past, in the present, and in the future. So Muchukunda, he passed his test. Krishna hinted to him that you can ask from me anything you like, but you and I know surrender is what you should ask for. That was implicit. Jiva Goswami points that out. Krishna assures Muchukunda that you fix your mind upon me the rest of your life, and then in your next birth, you'll achieve perfection. Three births. Just consider the inconceivably merciful opportunity we have that in the midst of the age of Kali, we can go back to Godhead in this lifetime. As the Bhagavatam states, Kalim Sabha Jayanchaya, great saints and sages worship Kali Yuga because you can go back to Godhead so easily simply by chanting Hare Krishna. What it took Muchukunda three births to do at least, you can do in this lifetime. That is the mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Sri Nityananda Prabhu. So these are some aspects of this particular leela. I thank you for your kind attention. Hare Krishna. Are there any questions? I knew it.
Hare Krishna. Hare Krishna.
Yes.
Hare Krishna. Maharaj, in the later part of this chapter, Lord Krishna tells Muchukunda that even the greatest of the yogis, their heart is not completely cleansed, whereas Muchukunda, your heart is completely pure. And you have no material desires. That is your good fortune. You know, Lord says that. I had a question, Maharaj, that when Muchukunda saw the Lord in the cave first, why did he not know the Lord's identity? Because the Lord told him that you were my pure devotee in the previous life, and I have appeared here to give you my darshan now. You know, so it seems. Muchukunda didn't seem to know the Lord, and after the Lord revealed himself, then he is sort of connected with him.
It's a subtle situation. The explanation given by Prabhupada and the previous acharyas is that he knew this has to be the Supreme Personality of Godhead. At the same time, he's going through a process of elimination to established that, even though he knew, still he wanted to be very methodical. He's careful. He's showing that bhakti is nothing whimsical, and the identification of the Supreme Personality of Godhead is nothing capricious, and it's not fairy tale. Like every village is Bhagavan. That's why he's doing that. Okay. Demigod? No. This must be. In other words, this must be who I think it is, who I know it is. He's showing how serious is Bhagavad Dharma, the science of the Supreme. Yes.
Mataji, in the part of lecture where you spoke about identity, and where there is one approach which is a reductionist approach, another approach which says that it is just a brain phenomenon. But there is one more approach which they say this whole thing about spirituality and religion is created by some good leaders of the society to maintain the society in a motivated and moral way. This is also another approach. How do we respond to that?
Without Parameshwara, the Supreme Controller, who decides what is actually moral? If Dharma is in the hands of ordinary human beings, then it'll be, as Freud said, religious codes or morals are like traffic regulations. They vary country to country. When people start to think in that way, when human beings start to think in that way, then they say, well, it's all relative and arbitrary. The religious codes in this country, the religious codes in that country. That's what young people in India are starting to think now. The Dharma that our parents gave us, our grandparents gave us, well, that was for a particular place and time. Ultimately, there is no guiding principle except what you yourself think is right. That's what it's all coming down to. And since you cannot run a society, even from the material point of view, in which everyone thinks that morals and rights are just up to you, since you can't actually run a society that way, therefore you need surveillance. And that's what's going on in the USA. It's become the world's most advanced surveillance society. Because how are you going to keep everyone together? You've got people of different nationalities, people of different religions, and in any way, what is right just depends on what you as the individual thinks. How are you going to keep a society together that way? There's very little nationalistic spirit in the traditional way. There's very little religious spirit compared to the strength of traditions in the past. Therefore, there must be a police state, a very sophisticated surveillance system. And that's what's happening now in the world. So this idea that religion and moral codes are something created, a sociological creation to keep order in society, it's not the latest. The latest is that won't actually keep the order in society, because actually each person has his own view of what is right. Okay, you can have your own view of what is right, but the government will be watching you, recording everything. There are various strands of depraved thinking. Take the science of the Supreme out of the equation, and the things that the best material brains in the world come up with is quite frightening. So that's why I was speaking yesterday at Soumya College about biomedical moral enhancement. Since you are just chemicals, and your conscious state can be influenced by changing neurochemistry, why not inject you with chemicals that will make you more cooperative, that will make you more altruistic, charitable? Why not? You're already just prescribing millions of people on antidepressants. Isn't that neurochemistry? Athletes are taking performance enhancers. Quite common. They may get caught, they may not, but still they're doing it. Academics are taking cognitive enhancers so they can concentrate better. Mm-hmm. And then people in their sense gratification are taking lust enhancers. So then why not take enhancers to make persons who will cooperate to solve global warming and nuclear weaponry? It all makes sense, right? You're a doctor, right? What a business you... There may be some rare argument amongst, or disagreement amongst the brahmacharis in the temple. Take him to Bhakti on the hospital, inject them. Be practical. So I explained yesterday, these are Oxford scholars and scientists who are putting this forth, not crackpots, you know. They're saying, look, let's face it, this is the coming reality. Since you are just neurochemicals, then what is the harm? And you have to try this. Otherwise human beings will destroy themselves through weapons of mass destruction, through environmental destruction. We've got to use everything at our disposal to solve this situation. So I gave a choice to the students yesterday. Would you prefer a solution like biomedical moral enhancement, or would you prefer to take Bhagavad Gita more seriously? Yes.
Hare Krishna. Maharaji, you mentioned in the class about time factor. Prabhupada makes it so clear that you forgot the time, but time didn't forget you. And you're speaking about the test also. Specifically in India, from last 6 months, the new government has come. And due to this new government which has come, the people over here are becoming prosperous, or they have a dream that they will be becoming very prosperous in India. The economical development, the GDP growth, and everything is improving right now in India. The inflation is also going down. Inflation is also going down. The GDP growth is also improved.
These are all indicators of real human progress, right?
Go on. So now what the people are feeling it is, the future of India is going to become very bright because the new government is there, and this government has got a stable members in the parliament. So this government is having a stability, and they will be taking a very bold decision. And due to that bold decision, the prosperity of India will be very bright in due course of time. My question to you, Maharaj, is that definitely it could be or it could not be, we don't know. But the scriptures are very clear that time is not going to change. The time is going to kill on us, and one day or the other we have to leave this body. At the same time, it could be a test of Krishna to make us diverted from away from Krishna consciousness and more getting attracted to those things. So how in this environment, when everything is looking very bright outside, we don't compromise our Krishna consciousness and we become very focused and see that our business is being done in this lifetime?
One thing is, you have to understand the way the world is functioning. There may be more wealth available in India, but who's going to get it? The fool thinks, oh, you know, the GDP is increasing, inflation is going down, there'll be more money for everyone. There'll be more money, mainly for those who already have money. That's the way the world is working now. The inequality of wealth is such a major issue in the world today. And who is the foremost acharya for inequality of wealth? The USA. And everyone is following that path. Mahajanayana Katap. So just, it may be true that temporarily, due to a government that's less corrupt and more efficient, there may be some bubbling of wealth. It may be true, but just, that doesn't mean that the average person is going to get it. In any case, all I know is that I've heard that Is it true? Your glorious Prime Minister went to Japan and presented Bhagavad Gita as it is. We offer all respects. He is the best among men. Just like I mentioned to His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj, as far as American politicians, the current president, his campaigning motto was, change we can believe in. Now everyone sees there was no change. The only change we can believe in is Dehi Knows Vidyatade. So that was his campaign motto. Everyone was so hopeful in 2008. Change we can believe in. Yes, you can. Yes, you can make a difference. Now, students in the USA were telling me how they've lost hope in any kind of political solution. Still, this president is the best amongst men. Why? He embraced the Vaishnav. He's the best. We have a different standard. You give Bhagavad Gita as it is to, you know, to the leader of Japan, or you embrace a Vaishnav, you are the best. Okay?
Hare Krishna. Maharaj, the decisions and the steps which the Prime Minister of India is taking, no doubt he is a spiritual-minded man. He is giving Bhagavad Gita. He speaks about philosophy of Krishna consciousness. He controls his senses. Although he went to USA, he didn't took anything except water because he was on fasting. At the same time, some schemes which he took it out. He recently, before 2 months back, he opened the accounts, all those people who didn't have accounts in India, all poor people, bank account. He made it open. 5 crore accounts have been opened for poor people in bank account. And this bank's accounts has been opened, and he will like to do all the benefits he would like to do through the banking system, and it will go directly to the old poor people itself. So all these systems which he is showing it makes little bit believe that the days are good. In that circumstances, I have a fear that we might not compromise our Krishna consciousness and get carried away with this.
If he can come to Radha Gopinath Mandir and he can meet with the devotees here, that will be extraordinary. So why not try to do that? Politics means politics. Don't harass a politician for being a politician. A politician is going to make politics. A capitalist is going to make money. You just try to connect it for some benefit so that people can become Krishna conscious. So don't have, you know, kind of like a high and mighty attitude. Ooh, he's making politics. Of course he's making politics. Just like the president of the USA, you know, in his presidential campaign in 2008. Change you can believe in. The days of business as usual in Washington, D.C. are over. This is campaign talk. He's being a politician. But what can he do in terms of helping the spreading of bhakti? That is our standard for measuring. That's our GDP. They'll talk so many other things. Let them talk. The opening of the big temple in Delhi, the prime minister at that time, he came, right? So this is glorious. Meanwhile, for actual substantial programs for upliftment. I've heard so many exciting things going on amongst the brahmacharis here. The village outreach, helping people in terms of food, helping them in terms of medical care, helping them in terms of learning, helping them in terms of business opportunities, and giving them the crest jewel of Krishna Bhakti. So, someone wants the complete solution, don't expect it from a politician. Have them come here and see what's going on. How you're offering solutions on all levels without forgetting what is the real medicine. Otherwise, what should I do? If I'm sick and I go to Bhaktivedanta Hospital and the doctors there help me, and then as I'm leaving I say, well, anyway, it doesn't really matter because I'm not the body. It's true I'm not the body. But they have helped in terms of the temporary body which is trying to engage in Krishna's service. So we appreciate help on all levels while at the same time understanding what is the real help. So in order to dramatize this point, sometimes acharyas, and Prabhupada was so powerful in this way, they will just kick away. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur was also like that. They would kick away any semblance of material help to dramatize the point that the only real solution is bhakti. Then again, sometimes, you know, in the last years, Prabhupada would say that we want to help people on all levels. So you have to be able to see this situation in a mature way. So if politicians can help the spreading of bhakti, they are the best. Politicians will talk. They'll make politics. They'll say things. They'll break their promises. It's all part of being a politician. Don't hold that against them. What do you expect? Prithu Maharaj? So I am very impressed by the way you all are approaching the situation in terms of the Govardhan Echo Project and the village outreach, and of course the college outreach has been going on for ages. And I don't see that anyone has forgotten what is the real medicine, what is the ultimate goal of life. I was speaking in Mayapur about, it's a final point, something Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur did in Mayapur Dham. He had a huge fair or exposition, and it covered a huge amount of area. And it had the wonder of electricity, which in the beginning of the 20th century in Mayapur, electricity was like a miracle. But he had his whole exposition grounds covering a massive area. It was all lit up by electricity. And he invited all the spiritual groups, all the sadhus to come. And he invited all the top mundane scholars to come. And everyone could have their exhibit. Mundane scholars could give lectures on their field of expertise. Sadhus from this group, that group could speak. There are even exhibits of relics or remnants of sadhus from here, sadhus from there. The music of all different types. And, of course, the Gaudiya Math was there. Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur's disciples were there. Giving knowledge as it is. So yes, if you have a strong core of devotees, you can do many bold things. And certainly what Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati Thakur did was extraordinarily bold. He wasn't afraid that his devotees would get bewildered. All right, bring all the sadhus, bring all the mundane experts, let them talk. they can talk at our exposition, but we will be there, and we are, in other words, we are so expert, we are so focused, we will prevail. That is very interesting. All right, so I thank you again for your kind attention. Hare Krishna.
Please wait, however, I will.